And now, Brother Jim Parkinson's discourse, knowledge or character? Knowledge or character? Brother Jim.
Good morning. This may be the last day of the convention, but it is the first day of the rest of your life. And if you wait 1,000 years or so, you'll be able to say, there will never be a last day of my life. Now, is there something wrong with the title of this talk? It might depend upon your vantage point. If you want to put knowledge first, then there's nothing wrong with the title of this talk. The other way around, and there is something wrong with it. We need both knowledge and character. But it's a good idea for us to lead with the character. I sometimes used an example. Let's see, I don't have the roving mic or the lapel mic today, do I? So we'll try to do this a little bit separately. If you look to Psalms 89:14, here, we'll fix the problem. I'll give everybody a chance to look for Psalms 89. Psalms 89:14. Righteousness, and this is from the American Standard Version, righteousness or the exercise of righteousness. Now, the four attributes of God can be found in three places symbolically in the Bible. The first chapter of Ezekiel, the 10th chapter of Ezekiel, and then in the 4th chapter of Revelation. Now, they occur in slightly different orders, emphasizing first, God's loving kindness. Second, God's justice. And third, God's power. That's the order in which we see them prominently exercised. God's loving kindness in creating the things of creation and making them all ready for his creation of mankind, which is perhaps the next to last of his creation. And then he rested for 4,000 years before starting the new creation. But because of the creation and fall, it was necessary for justice to come into effect next, and that was through the sacrifice of his Son, Jesus Christ, for each and every one. And after all, if Jesus Christ died once for all, then should not all benefit? And ultimately, power will come to the fore in the resurrection of the dead. Now, in Psalms 89:14, we see these attributes given not as symbols, but as names. Righteousness and justice are the foundation of thy throne. That's the two back legs there. And so that should be with us. We recognize power, the exercise of righteousness. Okay, sure. That's all right. We should put mercy and truth, or loving kindness and wisdom, out in front to lead the way. Because the Lord himself has done just that. Now, it seems self-evident that knowledge and character should not be at odds, but go hand in hand. Even so, character development should get started first and lead the way. In 1 Corinthians 8:1, remember, it says, knowledge puffeth up, but love buildeth up.
You can blow up a balloon, but it doesn't take much more than a pinprick to blow it up the other way. But if you fill the balloon full of something solid, it won't collapse, even if it's pricked. Knowledge puffeth up, but love buildeth up. So what are the things that we need to work on so that knowledge will be a benefit rather than something that does to us what it did to Lucifer? Do we have a temptation to be domineering? It is a temptation even more now than it has been through past ages as we get farther into the harvest. So often it is a result of a feeling of insecurity. And have you ever known of an age where insecurity was so widespread and perhaps to a degree so justifiable as it is now in the 21st century? Those who control self least are those who most demand to control others. Do I see that in me? Got to watch out for it. Now, we see it a lot in the political world, and we can see it in the religious world. So we know we are not immune from it. Those who control self least are those who most demand to control others. Now, one time I was driving home from work and had the radio on, and James Dobson and Focus and the Family came up, and it was talking about divorce in this case. And he says, usually in the case of a divorce, one of the parties is talking more than the other about the things that are wrong, accusing the other one. He says, you know immediately that's the one that is the guilty party. You first stop to think, can that be true? And then you stop to think, well, that must be true. Because after all, an innocent party doesn't feel driven to defend himself or herself. It's the one who is in the wrong who is driven to justify himself. Am I driven to justify myself in the things that I do? Now, I've thought sometimes of, in the studies in the scriptures, the six volumes of the studies in the scriptures, what is the least popular thing in the studies in the scriptures? And that will depend perhaps on what theological background one may come from. But for Bible students, what is the least popular part of the studies in the scriptures? My nomination for that would be in volume 6, page 314, item number 3. And I'll quote it sort of loosely, where Brother Russell suggests that one of the four best types of meetings, there should be regular, frequent meetings at which brethren would have an opportunity to present their best understanding of things, even if it is not that of the majority of the ecclesia. And I admit, bringing the question up among a number of brethren, some think, well, intellectually, it's probably a good idea, but I've never been to such a meeting. I must say, in over 50 years, I think I've only been to 2 or perhaps 3. But it's been kind of difficult for someone to say, hey, he's got to be wrong. And perhaps the only defense I can think of that seemed to me to make any have any degree of credibility. Somebody said, well, that was all right for Brother Russell's day, but now that we know everything, it no longer applies. Now, of course, my reaction to it can be quite different. When somebody else is coming up with a screwball idea, or at least that's my opinion of it, then I wonder at the advisability. On the other hand, if I'm the odd one out, I think it's a great idea. But even when I have a thought that I'm sure is scriptural and that others are missing the point, even there I need to be careful in that I don't make an issue of it. Maybe say it once or twice and let it go for a while, and maybe forever for that matter. But the thought that an idea which is bad should never be, a question like that should never be considered, Brother Russell handles not on page 314 itself in just a short paragraph, but in pages 317 to 319. And maybe for the sake of time, we ought to just say, okay, go ahead and look at it at your leisure. But it can be damaging if every other question is suppressed, other than the right question with the right answer. And in my experience, I have had some surprises. One of them goes back over 50 years ago in John 1:18. And the ancient manuscripts don't read like the King James. Most of the translators these days, not all, but most, recognize that, yes, there is definitely different Greek. And instead of saying, no man hath seen God at any time, the only begotten Son who is in the bosom of the Father, he hath declared him, it reads in the oldest manuscripts, and a lot of the oldest manuscripts, the four oldest plus several more, an only begotten God, he hath declared him. Well, that was certainly a surprise. Now, if you had a Trinitarian point of view, you'd be even more horrified, because it might imply that there's more than one God being spoken of in verse 1. Consequently, if you look among the translations, you can find an awful lot of paraphrases. I have to give the New American Standard Bible people credit here. They're one of the very few that translates it the way John wrote it. But there are not many more. Another surprise that I got was 1 Corinthians 15:51-2. Now from the American Standard Version, we would read, behold, I tell you a mystery. We all shall not sleep, but we shall all be changed in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet. But of the best manuscripts, there's only one or perhaps two out of the eight or nine best that support the King James reading there. The majority, by far, of the best manuscripts read just the reverse. Behold, I tell you a mystery. We shall all fall asleep, but we shall not all be changed in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, during the last trumpet. Now that's quite a difference. It certainly is understandable as Paul wrote it, as much of a shock as it may come to us to figure that out. But of course, think, if you had the concept of immortal souls, could you live with that reading? Hence, it was changed somewhere between the 3rd and 4th centuries. But it didn't squeeze it out of all of the manuscripts. There are still plenty of the best manuscripts, the majority, that read it just the reverse. We can understand each member of the consecrated class must fall asleep in death. But we shall not all be changed in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye. Twinkling of an eye, the shortest possible moment of sleep. During the last trumpet. Well, yes, that's right. Only they during the harvest period would be expected to be awakened as soon as they died, until the 144,000 is complete. Another surprise that I got, we'll call this one surprise number three, I guess, was in Matthew 5:32. Brother sent me an article on it. I think it was early last year. You may recall the context in the Sermon on the Mount. We can start with chapter 5, verse 27, just for context. You've heard that it was said, thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you that everyone that looketh on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery with her already in his heart. And if thy right eye causeth thee to stumble, pluck it out and cast it from thee. For it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not thy whole body be cast into Gehenna. And if thy right hand causeth thee to stumble, cut it off and cast it from thee. For it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not the whole body go into Gehenna. What do these two verses really have to do with what he's talking about? Verses 29 and 30. 29 is talking about the eye, the desire, the lust. 30, talking about the right hand, is what you do. Do you think about it? That's wrong. Do you commit the wrong? That also is wrong. So verses 29 and 30 are really conjunctions between 27 and 8 and 31 and 2. It was also said, whosoever shall put away his wife, let her, him give for her a writing of divorcement. But I say unto you, that everyone that putteth away his wife, saving for the cause of fornication, causeth her to commit adultery. And that's what the King James and most of the translations give. But they have ignored the verb tense. But if you read the verb tense as a past tense, how do you understand that? Everyone that putteth away his wife causeth her to have committed adultery. Now, how can you do that retroactively? Well, everybody knows that that can't be. So they think, well, Matthew must have just goofed in the tense that he used. A Greek reading that will likely conclude that's got to be the case. An Englishman, and Polish, and Romanian, whatever European language you may choose. And yet a Hebrew should have no difficulty with it at all. To say, whosoever shall put away his wife, and we'll skip the part about having committed adultery, everyone that putteth away his wife causeth her to be deemed to have committed adultery. And it is deemed whoever might marry her when she is put away committeth adultery. That is a very different thought. Now then, if we think about it, it makes perfectly good sense what he's saying here. And that is, if I were to divorce my wife, don't worry, I'm not planning on it. If I were to divorce my wife, people would suspect, is it because she committed adultery? Well, now if she'd already committed adultery, then I wouldn't be the cause. So that's why the other clause is put in there. But I would cause a suspicion on her that shouldn't be necessarily drawn. And it would be concluded that anyone that marries her afterwards is probably the one she committed adultery with. Now, it's a little difference. It's the same verb in each case, but it's the tense that makes the difference. And I must admit, that came as quite a surprise to me. Nor am I finished with surprises. I guess I won't really have time enough to go into this in much detail. But 1 Corinthians chapter 7. We have three different cases given here in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, the marriage chapter. In verses 10 and 11, it's talking about a case of a believer is married to another believer. Beginning with chapter 12, it's talking about a believer is married to an unbeliever. But when we get down to verse 25, it's a little different story, verses 25 through 28. Here he is addressing a case where, in this case it's a man, has already been divorced. Is he allowed to marry a virgin woman? And so, now concerning virgins, I have no commandment of the Lord, but I give my judgment as one that has obtained mercy of the Lord to be trustworthy. I think, therefore, that it is good by reason of the distress that is upon us, namely, that it is good for a man to be as he is. In other words, whichever way he is. Art thou bound to a wife? Seek not to be loosed. That is, are you married? Don't look for a divorce. Art thou loosed from a wife? Seek not a wife. Are you divorced? Don't look for a wife. And then this raises the eyebrow in verse 28. But shouldest thou marry, thou hast not sinned. And if a virgin marry, she hath not sinned. That sort of takes one aback. I've got to think about this a bit. But when I went back to verse 25, it was though I had never seen this verse in my entire 50 plus years. Maybe it's closer to 60. And Paul says, now concerning virgins, I have no commandment of the Lord. How can he say that? Doesn't he know about Matthew 19 or Mark chapter 10? That was my first reaction. Second reaction was, oh no, just when I knew everything, this had to come up. The only way that so far I've begun to harmonize it, going back to Matthew 19, and that would be about verse 9. We'll settle for that. We won't have time to really dwell on it. But I'll say this much, although I do not have a complete answer on this question, I am quite open to thoughts that you may have or get, so please share them. Matthew 19:9, and I say unto you, whosoever shall put away his wife except for fornication and shall marry another committeth adultery. Well, in a way it seems clear, but there is one possible question here. Does he mean, whosoever shall put away his wife, except for fornication, and shall ever marry another in his whole life? Or does he mean, whosoever shall put away his wife in order to marry another, committeth adultery? My tentative conclusion is somewhat along this line that in 1 Corinthians 7:25, he's saying, it's really the latter, because I have no commandment from the Lord. In other words, the case that he's talking about is not what's being covered by Matthew 19:9. But he's saying, the one branch of the Pharisees that says, oh, a man can divorce his wife for any cause that he wants, even if she only spoiled the coffee. And our Lord then is saying, you want to just, you don't want to commit adultery, so you're going to trade in the old wife on a new model. He says, you've already committed adultery, as far as the Lord is concerned. And it doesn't necessarily then address at all the case of what happens if the wife has driven the husband to distraction, or vice versa. Happens both ways. And what happens in a case where a wife has on one or more occasions tried to kill her husband without quite succeeding? Is he forced to be with her the rest of his life until he is dead and can't do anything about it anyway. And it's really difficult, at least for me, to imagine that that is the case. So perhaps what Jesus is addressing in Mark 10 and Matthew 19 is when a man divorces his wife in order to marry another, then he has committed adultery. I'll be interested in other thoughts as well. Now then, on some of these four surprises that I've mentioned, the question would be about my attitude. What is my attitude towards someone who differs on these points or on other points? That's where the character development comes in. Now, we are all ignorant. You know that. We are all ignorant, just about different things. I have things that I have just recently learned, and I have more things that I need to learn. The Lord knows which ones they are. But when I stop learning, I think it'll be time to give me a granite headboard. Now we get to the case of knowledge, and Brother Nathan, can we have that slide up? Oh, it's there? Okay. It's on there already. Good. Okay. In John 13, I might try for a little light myself. In John 13, Jesus says, "Ye call me teacher and Lord, and ye say, well, for so I am. If I then, the Lord and the teacher, have washed your feet, ye also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example, that ye also should do as I have done to you. Truly, truly, I say unto you, a bondservant is not greater than his Lord, neither an apostle that is sent greater than he that sent him. If ye know these things, blessed are ye if ye do them." Ah, there's the if clause. If ye know these things, blessed are ye if ye do them. Is there any blessing promised if we know them and we don't do them? Knowledge is there for the purpose of application. And now we'll go to some of the applications that we have in our own time, in this part of the age in which we live. Now, one of the remarkable things is to compare the history of our own time, say the last 140 years, that in sequence, the major world events have been a long depression, World War I, the Great Depression of the 1930s, World War II, the East versus West struggle. I will suggest, without explaining it at this point at least, the next one is a deep depression, and the last one will be Armageddon. If you're a historian, you're probably thinking, oh boy, this age in which we live is chaotic. If you're one of the rich and established families, you're thinking, chaotic isn't the word for it, it's a disaster. But if you were a Jew in Israel, you might have a very different view of things. Because every one of these major world events has contributed one thing towards the restoration of Israel. That restoration that was promised already in Deuteronomy. The dispersion was prophesied, and the return was prophesied. Now, if we go back to the early 1870s, a Jew could not go and buy and own land there and return and settle in Israel, at least not legally, not if he got caught. At most, he was permitted a 3-week visa to go visit, and then he had to get out. But when the Long Depression began, and it would be in Austria, they had a stock market collapse. I think it was in May of 1873, and In September, there was a similar one in New York. Well, that's usually, you know, people have had famines before, and people have had depressions before. But coinciding with this depression was an event in the Balkan Peninsula where they had a fall planting in 1874 that yielded a terrible harvest in the spring of 1875. The Ottomans, who controlled that area, demanded just as much tax as before, and Christians and other non-Muslims were taxed two or three times what Muslim farmers were. That was part of their means of conversion. And there was nothing to pay the taxes with, so the soldiers came in and took everything that they could find. They took the furniture, they took the food, the whole works. And it sparked a Christian revolt against the Ottoman Empire. And that would include, first, the Roman Catholic Christians, and second, the Eastern Orthodox Christians. It led to a bankruptcy of the Ottoman Empire in 1875. Now, whole countries don't generally declare bankruptcies, but it earned the Ottomans no friends in Europe because they refused to repay their loans to the European countries, the so-called Christian countries. As a result, when the only Jewish prime minister that Britain has ever had, he was there at the 1878 time frame, at the Congress of Berlin, he could point out to the head of the Ottoman Empire, you know, you've got this worthless land in Palestine and you're broke. Why don't you sell it? We can find buyers for it. And the Pasha, or whatever his name is, had to acknowledge that that really was a pretty good idea. As a result, the first new Jewish community was reestablished in Palestine in October of 1878. The next month, there was another one, and practically every month thereafter, there was a new Jewish community reestablished. The Aliyah had begun. World War I, it brought about the Balfour Declaration, making Palestine a homeland for the Jews. And the Great Depression, there was a great persecution of the Jews in Central Europe. They were driven out of Central Europe, and surprise, the Jewish population in Palestine grew from 1% of the total Jewry to 3% of total Jewry. Came World War II and Adolf Hitler, which drove the Jews from Central Europe and a lot of Western Europe, and by 1949 it was now 10%. And Israel had become a nation. During that time since World War II, Israel became independent. The Jews began returning from Eastern Europe, especially the former USSR. Over 1 million have left the Soviet disunion, most of them going to Israel. Now, I will sidetrack just for a moment, but I've noted that if you take the 10 plagues in Egypt, see how I'm doing in time, not too well. The 10 plagues in Egypt, the first three fall on the Israelites and the Egyptians. Moses doesn't have a part in it. He says, say unto Aaron thy brother, do this, do that, do the third thing. But for the last seven plagues, Moses takes the dominant role and the Lord begins the separation that there will be no more plagues in the land of Goshen where my people dwell. That is, Christ at his return takes the dominant role and begins the harvest work of separation of the people. We go through the plagues. Numbers 2, 4, 5, and 7 are destructive. They kill things or animals. Well, we look at the seven events from that period of time, and we find number 2, World War I, number 4, World War II, those are both destructive. And the next one, the East versus West conflict that ended in the local revolutions, certainly anything but a depression. And the last one will be Armageddon. However, 1, 3, and 6 were plagues that were not destructive. And it would seem to me they correspond to depressions. The plague in Exodus was a plague of darkness, thick darkness that could be felt, so that no man could move from his place for 3 days. Now that sounds like an economic freeze, doesn't it? And the river Euphrates was dried up in the Revelation plague. That was the river that Babylon depended upon for its commerce, its wealth, its existence. It might suggest, then, that the Jews will be having experiences here in the Americas similar to what they did in Germany before World War II. I don't like the idea. You don't like it either. But it could lead to the Jews' return from the Americas, where over half of the remaining non-Israeli Jews still live. More than 40% of Jewry has already returned. But there are still about 6 million in this country. And then there's more in Canada and in Argentina in particular. And when we come to Armageddon, that will be the time when Israel's enemies destroy each other. That will be the time when the ancient worthies are raised. And that will be the time when it is good news for everyone. Now, one can also trace in the final column the effect that these plagues have had on sectarianism. Every one of them has been destructive to sectarianism. The same plague that has been constructive to Israel has been destructive to Babylon. The Lord knows what he's doing, and he is doing it very systematically. Now, from a practical point of view, what should we do if we're on the threshold of a deep depression? I think many of you would be disappointed if I didn't say, number one, get out of debt and stay out of debt. Number two, keep away from all of the stampedes of people who hate the Jews, hate Israel. And it is certainly growing in this world today. And borrowing from Tim Thomason, always preach the gospel. Use words when necessary. Now, in conclusion, every major world event since Christ's return contributes to Israel but damages Babylon. You and I can see it event by event by event. And now the real question is, what is my attitude towards that unenlightened fellow? See my halo? What is my attitude towards the unenlightened fellow who just can't see it? Will I be charitable? Will I be merciful? Because we want to recall it is mercy and truth that gets out in front and leads the way.